This morning, what we're going to do is we're going to look at the sort of general area of spiritual friendship. And I said a bit last night, but I'll say again that Karen Adee and I were keen on doing this theme because spiritual friendship is the heart of the order. In a way, it is the essence of the order. Sometimes the order is described as a network of Kalyana Mitrata, a network of spiritual friendship. So in a way, it's what we're kind of moving towards. We're moving towards entering into the order, which is a network of spiritual friendship. And we do that also by a path of friendship, allowing people to get to know us and getting to know other people. And spiritual friendship is often the key to the ordination process. It's interesting because what you can get is you can get some practitioners training for ordination I remember a friend of mine described herself as a mess in progress. So they can very much feel that they're a mess in progress. I don't think that particularly ends at ordination, but you can feel like you're really working on yourself, really developing yourself. But you've got very, very good friends that you share that journey with. And who support you in that journey. Or you can have someone who feels actually they're very effective in their practice. They're very well disciplined. They often have a very good meditation practice. But they're doing it at home and they can feel actually somewhat isolated in that practice. And there's no one sort of sharing that inner life or witnessing that inner life. So in the ordination process, what we're doing is we're bringing together those two strands. We're bringing together your own going for refuge in your personal practice and the witnessing of that practice. And witnessing can sound very passive. You know, it's a bit like, you know, no one can get inside your head and see what's going on in your meditation. It's not a passive process. It's more like a mutual communication and a mutual sharing of your practice. So what happens is, that personal practice of yours, your effective going for refuge, comes together with your with sharing that practice in the context of your friends. And of course, they're not separate, those two strands, because if you've got good friends, you'll have the encouragement to practice more deeply. Your good friends may even encourage you to go on solitary retreat, for example, or to develop your meditation practice at home. And I know sometimes people have a kind of meditation buddy that they ring up and talk about their meditation with. And also, if you're practicing very dedicatedly at home on your own, or you've got a very intensive personal practice, then naturally, it's the nature of spiritual practice itself that you'll want to share. So spiritual friendship is not just a box to tick on the ordination process, like I have some mates in the order, therefore I'm going to get ordained. It's not like that at all. The Buddha described spiritual friendship as the whole of the spiritual life. So just to recap on that story, many of you have heard it before. Ananda says to the Buddha, he said, well, you know, I've been thinking and spiritual friendship really is half the spiritual life. And the Buddha says, say not so, Ananda, say not so, for spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. And then he goes on to say something quite interesting. He said it's due to our spiritual friends that we're able to develop the Noble Eightfold Path. It's with the help and support of our spiritual friends that we practice the Eightfold Path. He also says it's with the support of our friends that we develop the quality of viveka, which can mean solitude or it can mean independence of heart. So that's quite interesting. He's saying actually it's spiritual friends that enable us to develop the quality of being able to be on our own as well. And he said it's due to your spiritual friendship with me, as in the Buddha, that one encounters the Dharma and is able to practice the Dharma. And Bhante Sangharakshita is has got quite a lot to say about spiritual friendship. In a way, he's really, really developed this whole area and the importance of spiritual friendship in the spiritual life. And he says it's the nature of spiritual life itself that when you leave behind a kind of neurotic self-clinging, obviously you realize that you're part of a greater whole. You realize that fundamentally you're not alone, that actually we're not fixed and we're not separate from other beings and to the whole of nature and the environment. So he says it's part of this nature of the spiritual life itself that one wants to share. It's part of the nature even of human beings that they want to communicate and share their lives, because we're not separate and we're not alone. And he says that even the Buddha needed to communicate, and he needed to communicate not just because he had some sort of need he wanted to fulfill, not because he wanted to make himself feel better. You know, it's not like the Buddha didn't sleep very well and wanted to tell someone about it. Because he didn't identify himself as a subject isolated from the external world, isolated from objective reality, or self-isolated from others, that it was in the nature of his life that he wanted to share. And one finds this again and again in the early Buddhist scriptures. I think my favourite of these stories, which I often tell, but I find it very, very fascinating, is that the Buddha had his disciple Ananda, as we know, who's his companion for over 20 years, maybe 25 years. And there's a story that once they're in Sarvati, so means that he was, it was probably a bit later on in his life. Anyway, so he called out Ananda in Sarvati. It's where the Buddha spent the rainy season. So he wandered most of the time, but when the rains came, he settled in one place. So he settled in Sarvati, and he called out Ananda, and he said, Ananda, what do you think of Sariputta? Now, Sariputta was the Buddha's main disciple and a great friend of both the Buddha and Ananda. So it was a bit of a leading question, because Ananda was not going to say, like, I've been meaning to say, you know, I'm finding it really difficult. Ananda said, what he would naturally say, he said, well, Sariputta is a great man. He's of great wisdom, bright wisdom, sharp wisdom. He lives contentedly with few wants. And he starts to rejoice in the merits of Sariputta. And the Buddha says, so it is, so it is. Sariputta is of bright wisdom, sharp wisdom, and he is a few wants and contented. And they start rejoicing in Sariputta together. And at that moment, something extraordinary happens. Their rejoicing attracts the gods. So these are the devas that live around Sarvati. And a group of them come, young gods, so quite specific about that. Some young gods come, young devas come to listen to the rejoicings. And they start rejoicing in the merits of Sariputta too. But as they're rejoicing, being of the nature of gods, they start to glow in different colours. So we're told that they glow like the sun rising on an autumn day, like a precious jewel on a gold cloth, or like when the sunlight hits gold. They start radiating rainbow lights all around Sarvati. I'm imagining this is probably at night time, because that's when the gods usually come. So you can imagine there's two perhaps elderly men who've known each other for a long, long time, been friends and companions for a long, long time. Ananda knew everything about the Buddha, everything. Even if he wasn't present, he would ask for any teaching that the Buddha gave to be recounted to him later. So these two old men sit in Sarvati and light starts shining around them. Gods start arriving and they're all rejoicing in the merits of Sariputta. And at no point does Sariputta arrive. The sutta just ends there. Presumably they all go to bed at that point. I don't know. So, yes, it ends with the Buddha, the gods rejoicing in Sariputta in verse. So that's, I think they start singing his praises. And the Buddha responds in verse, which I should imagine, again, was some kind of chant or singing. And he rejoices in the merits of Sariputta, and he said, "Ah, Sariputta, adorned by the teacher's praise, he awaits the time," which means he awaits for his final enlightenment. And I find this exceptionally beautiful as a story. I hope I've evoked something of that for you. Because I find it extraordinary that someone like the Buddha would rejoice in the merits of his friend for fun. I mean, there was no lead-in to that. And we hear the same in the story of Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who's a very, very great Nyingmapa master. And it's said that his disciple said that when he had an evening off, he gave very intensive teaching schedules and retreat schedules, and also met with people individually a lot. But sometimes he had the evening off. So when he had the evening off, his great delight was to gather around his disciples and rejoice in the merits of his teachers. And when he did that, tears were pouring down his face. He just delighted in his teachers so much that tears would just roll down his face. And that's what he would enjoy to do of an evening. Sangharakshita says, "There exists within the enlightenment experience, within the heart of reality, an element of communication, an element of spiritual friendship, something that found expression in the later history of Buddhist thought as that rather mysterious concept of Sambhogakaya." That's a quote from a talk he gave called The Case of Dysentery. Not the greatest title for a talk, but anyway, very worth listening to. But Sambhogakaya means, it literally means the body of mutual enjoyment. And it's really the sort of Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas of imagination. That kind of archetypal realm. But he doesn't go into it that much. But what he's saying is very profound. There exists within the enlightenment experience, within the heart of reality, an element of communication, an element of spiritual friendship. So what we're dealing with here is not just a kind of path that one has to, you know, tick off and then get enlightened or get ordained or whatever it is. It's something profound and far-reaching. So what is it? In Pali, we say Kalyana Mitrata. I've written it on this piece of flip chart, which is rolling itself up, but can be unrolled at some point. It's from the root kal, which means to impel, incite, or urge on. So Kalyana Mitrata, Kalyana means, sometimes it's translated as spiritual, sometimes it's translated as beautiful. Mitrata is friendship. But yes, it has this root kal, which means that the meaning of Kalyana has not only an aesthetic quality, but also a moral quality. It implies that what is beautiful is also ethical and true. So it's more of the line of that sort of three meanings, if you like. What is beautiful, morally good, and true. And it's helpful. It's helpful in the sense that it leads us onwards. It impels us, incites us, and urges us on. And of course, it leads us, in a Buddhist context, it leads us to a greater understanding of reality. So that what that means is that the Kalyana-Mitrata relationship is one that's based on what is good and true and beautiful, and leads us on to what is good, true, and beautiful. It leads us on to higher levels and is helpful to us. Sangharakshita is very specific in his use of language, and he says, in a way, he doesn't really like the word spiritual, but that's the best we've got. But he does go into what it means. And he says spiritual means consisting in skillful mental states. So you could say that spiritual friendship is that which takes us up the spiral path into more and more skillful states, into more positive, ethical and joyful, beautiful states of mind, into states of peace, friendliness and wisdom. So Kalyana Mitrata is something to also aspire to. It's something to, it's an ideal to grow into, as well as something that we already have. It might be helpful to bring in Aristotle's definition of friendship, because he talks about friendship as being based on either pleasure, utility, or love of the good. So pleasurable friends are friends that we kind of unite with on the basis of we enjoy their company. So we gain some pleasure out of that. Friendship based on utility is people who we work with, or we gain some sort of benefit from, who help us with a particular project. And Aristotle says that friendship based on pleasure or utility sort of come and go, because sometimes we don't find our friend pleasurable, and sometimes we don't find them useful. So you know that if if you enjoy a certain thing. I used to live in Sheffield, and Sheffield's got a lot of climbers in it. And often what you'd find is there was this difficult transition. If people decided to give up climbing, what happened to their climbing friends? You know. So those were friends that were based on pleasure and utility. And what happens when you leave work, for example? Do you maintain those friendships that you have? Or you leave a certain, you go out clubbing with your friends or to the pub with your friends. What happens when you stop doing those things? And there can be that sort of difficult thing of, well, do you really keep up with them or not? But he said if you've got a friendship that's based on love of the good, that remains. That remains constant through pleasure, through utility. That's the kind of enduring friendship. So in a way, his idea, Aristotle's idea, is similar to Kalyana Mitrata. Love of the good as a basis for friendship is slightly different and more enduring. And what we do with friendship of based on love of the good is we move away from friendship purely based on the need for pleasure, or the need for or social and economic need, or the need for praise and status. So we're moving away from friendships based on need to friendships based on a shared love of the good. You could even look at it from a Buddhist terminology as friendship based on the worldly winds, the desire for pleasure, gain, praise and status, towards something that's beyond that, beyond all those values. So Bhante does talk about friendship, spiritual friendship, as a going forth from friendship based on the worldly winds to friendship based on something much more enduring, friendship based on skillful mental states and the spiral path. He talks about going forth from neurotic need, wanting friendship to fulfill something missing in us that they can't ever possibly fulfill. And we all know that feeling, there's that feeling where there's a sudden emptiness that we're trying to fill, and we don't even know what it is or what would help us fill it. And it's very easy then to sort of grasp after friends. But then when we don't have that feeling, what do we do about the friends? So we'll explore that on this retreat, that kind of dynamic. So we're going forth from friendship based on neurotic need to friendship based on love of the good, spiritual friendship. So having said all that, spiritual friendship does not necessarily immediately mean just Buddhist friendship, and you've got to sort of dump all your non-Buddhist friends. I have to say, I've had the same best friend since she was born. And my earliest memory, she's called Claudia, and my earliest memory is of being in a playpen with her listening to Nelly the Elephant. and I remember she's completely the opposite to me. I was very, very skinny as a child, like you could see my ribs and everything, and I had this short dark hair, and she had this total pudding basin of thick blonde hair, and she was quite plump. And I remember looking at her in the playpen, feeling this such complete love and delight for this little podgy being. And also feeling profoundly moved by the words of Nelly the elephant, because she packed her trunks and said goodbye to the circus and went into the wild, which probably set up the rest of my life, really. You know, so my best friend Claudia is part of my being. There is no way that I would become a Buddhist and say, right. Even though I did go through a phase when my mum said, I remember the phase when you lost your sense of humour. I didn't go through the phase where I just dropped my best friend. But what I've noticed is that as I've become a Buddhist and practiced the Buddhist life, is that that friendship also grows in skillfulness. So we live very different lives. She's got two kids, and I live in a Buddhist community in Wales. She lives in London. But actually, our relationship, there is a going forth within that relationship of unskillful states of mind or of the worldly winds, and a friendship that's based on mutual respect and love. So that going forth can happen within a friendship as well. It's not that, you know, that you have to just get rid of the bad friends and have good friends. Sometimes, actually, you can develop that skillfulness within the friendship, and I've really appreciated that with Claudia over the years, because yes, you know, we've given up our naughty habits that we got into in our teenage years, and yes, something very, very rich has emerged, and I'm pretty sure that that friendship is lifetimes as well. I have a very strong sense of that. But you do have to make a choice. Sometimes you do actually have to make a choice, particularly if there are certain friends that encourage you in unskillful behaviour. When I was reflecting on this theme and writing these talks, I had a dream. And I had a dream. I was in a kind of student flat, and they were all hipsters. So they all had beards. The blokes all had beards, and they were all sort of looking like hipsters, whatever hipsters looked like in my dream. And I was feeling like I didn't really belong because I'm a little bit older. I didn't realise I was kind of twice their age. And they were taking drugs out of this there was this chocolate box, and they were like, ooh, what shall I have? Some ketamine or some MDMA? And I was trying to join in. I knew I didn't really want to take any drugs at all. So I would kind of trying to laugh and join in, but hope that no one noticed that I wasn't taking anything out of this chocolate box. And then for some reason we went somewhere where they were all in their own respective mental states, depending on what they took out of the chocolate box. And I was this woman, and I realised she had children, and I was a bit worried about these children. And we went on the tube, and she had all these bags, and I was trying to help her, but I realised I hadn't bought a tube ticket. And I was like, oh, my God, that's taking the not given, but I need to help her with the bags. And I woke up in a bit of an anxious state, and I realised that actually, yes, there is something about friendships where you just feel like you don't belong anymore and you're trying to help. You're kind of trying to be a positive influence in that situation, but it's too much for you. And that's what I felt in this dream, that, you know, there's some situations where we can transform those situations with our positivity. And then there's some where actually you're going to have less influence on them than they are on you. Mm. And sometimes you just have to make that choice. At least for now. It's very, very difficult to be in a situation of friendship that's unskillful and remain positive. You've got to have an incredible amount of positivity to do that. And inner integrity. Even enlightened beings, there's a story of Purana, who in the time of the Buddha, who was an enlightened being, and he said he wanted to go to the west of India and establish a Sangha there, and that was sort of around the area of Mumbai. And at that time, 2,500 years ago, it was like the Wild West, you know. It was really, really dangerous and difficult. And the Buddha actually questioned Purana. He said, well, what are you going to do when people speak unkindly to you? And Purana said, well, I'll think to myself, at least they're not hitting me with their fists. And he said, well, what do you do when they do hit you with their fists? And he said, well, I'll think to myself, at least they're not stabbing me with knives. And the Buddha said, well, what do you do when they do stab you with knives? And he said, well, at least they're not killing me. And he said, well, what do you do when they do kill you? And he said, well, I'll think to myself, well, at least I'll be released from this filthy, stinking body. Which I think actually is meant to be a joke, by the way. It's all set up like this. But it's interesting that the Buddha would even question an enlightened being about how much he could really hack it, you know, on his own, in the days before mobile phones and Skype. Anyway, it goes on, that story, but we'll leave that to another time. So yes, and also it's not to say that one shouldn't experience pleasure or utility from friendship that's based on love of the good. You know, spiritual friendship is easier when we enjoy each other's company. It's easier when we work together. It's a good way to get to know each other, as I'm sure you've all experienced this morning. I find that a real joy, actually, spending the last week here with a team, getting to know them as we all work together. You do see a different side of each other. You know, you can't maintain a front for very long when you're digging or putting up a structure and the poles aren't quite the right lengths and you can't find the last one, you know. You can't remain a front. So there is something very positive about a spiritual friendship that also has pleasure and utility in it. But I suppose what spiritual friendship means is that when pleasure and utility are removed, the friendship remains sustained by deeper currents. And I definitely find that with my life at Te Ratnaloka. You know, I do enjoy the company of my friends at Te Ratnaloka, Karen Adi included. I enjoy your company. You know, when I see Karen Adi, my heart lifts and I think, oh, everything's all right. And I get a bit excited. And she arrived at the site, I was terribly excited, you know, and I feel happy and, you know, we hang out and we enjoy each other's company. And she's also very useful as a general person. you know, we work together well, I hope. And we can do a lot together. We're very effective together in our team at Te Ratnaloka. But there's also another quality, because of course sometimes those things do fail. You know, sometimes we all have difficult moods or difficult things going on in our lives. We can be annoying and difficult and sometimes a bit unskillful, sometimes ineffective and unhelpful and grumpy. You know, so you need a friendship that's going to sustain through all that. And I think the main thing for me in spiritual life is that we're all up for a certain amount of communication about things when they go wrong, as well as when they go right. And that dedication to communication is really important. Sangharakshita, when he's talking about spiritual friendship, he says, well, with spiritual friends, we can be ourselves as full spiritual beings. We can be ourselves at our best. And in a way, I think we can also be ourselves at our worst, not to just, you know, don't not take any responsibility for that, but our friends can take both. And it's interesting that he should say that we can be ourselves at our best, because sometimes, you know, it is difficult not... Sometimes it's easier to express negative emotion than positive emotion. You know, so there is a risk sometimes to share one's inspiration. You know, to say, actually, I had a really good meditation this morning and things are really unfolding for me and I felt blissfully happy. You know, or I got into a higher state of concentration and, you know, I really saw something. It can feel like a risk to say that, as well as I woke up in a bad mood and I'm feeling a bit grumpy. Both of those are risks. It's a risk to share ourselves. But it's also very delightful and precious when we can do that, when we can fully be ourselves with people. And that they will also respond to us. So Bhante called spiritual friendship a vital mutual responsiveness on the basis of a common ideal and a common principle. So it's a vital mutual responsiveness through a sort of shared love of the good, for a shared vision, for a shared ideal and shared practice. And in that mutuality, that mutual responsiveness, the friendship is dynamic and ascending. It's dynamic because we change each other. It's mutual. We're communicating with each other. And it's ascending because we're lifting each other up towards the spiritual life. So in a nutshell, that's the sort of definition of Kalyana Mitrata, to be dynamic and ascending. And it's mutual because we both give and receive friendship. You know, if you find one of Sangharakshita's aphorisms, if you want more friends, then you need to be a friend. If you want friendship, you need to be a friend. I'd also add that you also need to be befriended. And I think this can be very difficult for people. It's not just about giving friendship. It's also about allowing yourself to receive friendship. That's part of the mutuality. So often we're waiting for the perfect friend or the perfect teacher to arrive and sort of sort everything out for us, when actually we're not seeing what we really have right here. You know, maybe we have that perfect friend and we're not seeing it. I won't go into it in detail, but sometimes we talk about three levels of metta, three levels of love or of maitri. So I'll just say about the first two. So if you want to investigate this further, you know, there's talks online. But the first level of metta is a level of which we're is a kind of ordinary love between people, that I give love to you, in a way. It's just a kind of it's a relationship based on discrete entities, if you want to be technical about it. So there's a sense that I'm here and I'm giving love to you, and you're giving me some love and communication. So it's kind of two-way like that. The second level of maitri is that of love between dharmas, which means that love between sort of two aspects, or more, love between aspects of reality, which is not fixed and not separate. The third level is not having any boundary at all, free-floating metta, without a centre, without a sense of any kind of ego identity at all. What we can do as Buddhists is we can do a lot of focus on the second level of metta, of metta as reality, between, you know, beings that are not fixed or not separate, and we can miss out the first level of metta. This is getting a bit technical, but some of you might know what I mean. The first level of metta needs to be cultivated and understood, and in what that is ordinary love of knowing that you are loved and loving. And sometimes we can just forget that ordinary level. It's the level at which we enjoy our friendships, where we give them gifts, where they give us gifts, and where we're grateful to them. I'd recently been on a long solitary, and I really wanted to really reflect on this first level much, much more, of the love that my friends and I have for each other. And what I did was I consciously took things with me that my friends had given me. So when I was on my own and, I put some hand cream on my hands, I knew that Punyamala had given me that hand cream. Or I lit some incense, Karanadi had given me the incense. Or, I was reading a book that Chandraprabha gave me. So all these things are just on the level of just ordinary love, ordinary friendship, allowing yourself to be loved and to give love. Very important. Need to speed up a bit. And within that spiritual friendship, what starts to emerge is that some people are in more skillful states than you are. You know, so spiritual friendship is based in skillful mental states. What you might start to notice is that you're with a friend and they are in more skillful states than you. And within that relationship, reverence naturally arises. So the word for reverence in Pali is garva. Garva literally means weighty. It means weighty with qualities. Sangharakshita says about it, the word garva has a richer connotation than is suggested by the English words used to translate it. It includes such emotions as admiration, wonder and delight in the fact that there exists or existed others superior to oneself in creative ability or spiritual attainment. So admiration, wonder and delight. And it's challenging for us that, because it does imply some sort of hierarchy. It does suggest that some people are in more skillful states than others. But it doesn't have to be something that's imposed from the outside. It's something that naturally arises when you're around someone. And you might notice that. You might notice that when you're around particular people, you're naturally more ethical, or you're naturally more in touch with your faith. Sometimes you're more naturally in touch with the things that you've done that are unskillful, and you feel some remorse or some free about that. But it's almost like the presence of someone who's in more skillful states than us draws something out of us. And Sangharakshita's point is that it's human nature, and the Buddha's point actually, it's human nature to respect and admire and to feel reverence for those people who are more skillful states than us. And he says that if you don't have that in your life, then it's suffering. That's what the Buddha said. It's suffering not to look up to someone. It's suffering not to revere and respect someone. In our particular Buddhist order, if you feel that consistently with someone, you might ask them to be your formal Kalyanamitras or preceptor. So we could talk about that in the groups if you want to know more about it. But Bhante makes the point that if that happens, if that kind of natural reverence emerges, it's the difference is in degree, not in kind. It's not like these people are the higher people and those are the lower people. It's something that emerges within a relationship. He says, as his understanding of what is ethically good in the everyday affairs of human life deepens into an understanding of what is spiritually desirable in the more complex issues confronting the soul, I love that, the more complex issues confronting the soul, the good friend becomes by insensible degrees the trusted counsellor, the spiritual guide or guru, the guru the bodhisattva, and the bodhisattva the Buddha. Just as among the colours of the rainbow, red emerges imperceptibly into orange, orange into yellow, yellow into green. So yes, so there are different colours within spiritual friendship. And Sangharakshita makes the point that ordinary spiritual friendship is a reflection of friendship with the Buddha. That actually it's not that friendship with the Buddha or friendship with the Guru or the Bodhisattva is completely different in kind. It's still friendship, but it takes on a different meaning, a different quality. Another issue around that, which you may want to discuss in the group, is about discipleship. So Sangharakshita defined the Triratna Buddhist order as the disciple. He said they're my disciples and the disciples of my disciples, which caused quite a large amount of debate, as it would, amongst the order. So you might want to explore this further. I find the whole ideal and mythology and kind of language of discipleship very rich, personally. In fact, I find it so interesting that I've been doing some research on it, discipleship in the Buddhist tradition, and I'm writing a book. So there you go. But yeah, it's something that we need to reflect on what that means. There's two issues really there. There's the general issue of discipleship itself, and then there's the issue of having Sangharakshita, being a disciple of Sangharakshita. They're related, but not exactly the same. And Sangharakshita recognised that for some people, discipleship is not an adequate description of their relationship with him. He says the main thing is that there is some emotional connection and gratitude that will arise for those who've introduced us to the Dharma. So he goes back to that kind of natural relationship, and that there's some emotional and connection and gratitude for the founder of the order which we want to join. Because of course, if we've asked to join the Triratna Buddhist order, the Triratna Buddhist order is an expression of Sangharakshita's understanding of his of the Dharma and his understanding of how we practice the Dharma. And, you know, that's what's informed the Tree Ratna Buddhist Order. It is what's informed the things we love about the Tree Ratna Buddhist Order, as well as the things we might find challenging. So we're going to have some sort of emotional connection and gratitude towards Sangharakshita for founding the order and for setting up something that has these qualities. The difficulty comes when we think about discipleship as being incompatible with any kind of criticism or of the teacher or of losing our individuality. So it's just important to realise that within that relationship, it is a natural reverence because we've said yes. It's not imposed from outside. It's some sort of qualities that we're attracted to and that we've said yes to. The Pali for disciple is Sāvaka, or Shravaka in Sanskrit, which means comes from a root which means hearing tradition or inspiration. So it means that you've listened to someone and you're inspired and you have an emotional response to that. You want to follow their teachings. But it sparks something off in yourself. And I think this is very true of the preceptor relationship, actually. Sometimes initiation is talked about sort of giving the preceptor, giving energy, giving spiritual energy to the disciple. And actually, it's not like that at all. It's more like because the preceptor can see something in the disciple or the ordinand, because they share a mutual love of the good, because they share their own going for refuge, the preceptor sparks off the person getting ordained. And it's very little to do with any kind of status or authority or anything like that, or any kind of giving over of practice or the ordinand losing their will or something like that. It's much more of a kind of sparking off, a ritual sparking off or kind of igniting someone's own inspiration. But it's theirs. And I've had the good fortune to ordain people myself, and there's very little of me in it. There's very little of me. It's very much about that person's ordination. And in a way, I'm just helping that to happen. Anyway, so it's a very, very beautiful and quite subtle thing, discipleship and sort of vertical Kalyana Mitrata. And there's also horizontal friendship as well. So Bhante distinguishes between vertical and horizontal friendship. Because often in the East, there's a lot of emphasis put on the vertical spiritual friendship relationship and not a lot put on the horizontal friendship. And then Sanghas become very, very centralized around a teacher. So when Sangharakshita set up this particular Buddhist order, he didn't want that to happen. He didn't want it just to be centralized around a teacher. He wanted there to be an atmosphere of friendship at all levels. And that's what he set the order up on the basis of. And in a way, the Buddha said the same thing. He said, you know, you've got to know people for a long time, not a short time, to understand their sort of spiritual attainments. He said, by living with people, you know their ethics. And by working with them, you know their integrity. By seeing them in good times and bad, you know their strength. And by discussing the Dharma with them, you know their wisdom. So that really suggests intimacy. It suggests getting to know each other very, very well and living our lives with each other. So I'm not going to talk about horizontal and vertical friendship separately because they are all just friendship. They're different aspects of the same thing. But you might want to talk about in your groups which one do you gravitate towards? Do you gravitate towards the vertical or the horizontal or both? Or do you find any of that uncomfortable or, you know, anything that arises for you in that area? So really the rest of the retreat is going to be about how we practice friendship, And friendship is a practice, it's action. We have to put in the effort. And it's something that we do, not something that we have. We don't have friends, in a way. We do friendship. We create that. One of Sangharakshita calls it a field of creativity. So it's friendship is an action that transforms unskillful to skillful states of mind, that transforms a lower state of being to a higher state of being even, or a contracted state of mind to an expansive state of mind. And because it does this, because it has this sort of transformative function, it's very similar to a magical rite. So a magical rite in Sanskrit is karman, which means from the word karma, which means action. So it just means it's a sort of intensified special action. And it's associated with different colours performing different functions. So this predates Buddhism. What Buddhism did is it took the ancient magical rites that were associated with different colours and different rituals, and it transformed them into something that's sort of self-centred, into something that gives and helps us transform from unskillful to skillful states of mind. So it uses the magical rites for a different end. So originally the magical rites were based on, well, if you wanted to, if there was some disharmony and you wanted to bring peace, you'd do the white spell of pacification. And if you were in love with someone and you wanted them to love you back, you'd do the red love spell, the rite of fascination. And if you wanted your crops to ripen, you'd do the yellow spell of wealth, the yellow rite of prospering. And if your enemies are causing you trouble, you'd do the blue-black spell of destruction. So what Buddhism did is it took all those magical rites because it could see that ritual and colour is transformative, but it would use them to a different end. So you're moving from manipulating others to get what you want to a way of giving to others and helping. And the Buddha did the same thing. At the time of the Buddha, we have the story of Sigala. And Sigala, we're told that the Buddha went out and he found a young man doing some rituals. So Sigala we're told he had wet hair and a wet body. And the Buddha said to him, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, before my father died, he said to me that I had to honour the six directions ritually every morning." And the Buddha said, "Well, it's good that you do that. So here's how you can do that more effectively." So he didn't dismiss the ritual action. He didn't say, "No, you don't do ordinary magic. Now you're going to do this." What he did is he transformed it into different ways of honouring the six directions. And he talked about Sigala's duties towards the six directions. The east being your duties towards your parents, the south being your duties towards your teachers, sort of secular teachers, the west your duties towards your spouse and children, the north your duties towards your friends, below you the duties towards the, well, servants, but doubt many of us have servants, so people who work in the service industries and serve us in that way, workers, and above your spiritual teachers. And he talked about the duties that you have towards all of those people. So he talked about, we're going to focus on the friendship part which is in the north. And he said that friendship has four duties, which are also the qualities of friendship. So it's interesting because it's saying that if you want to be a friend, you need to, the sort of qualities of friendship that you want to cultivate, you cultivate by doing those qualities as well, by doing particular duties. And those duties are the Sangraha Vastus. So we've got them written up on the board and we'll go through them day by day according to each magical rite. In a way, there's some parallels between them. Yeah. Because, yes, in the Buddhist tradition, if you want vision, you've got the Mahayana. If you want the kind of direct route of transformation in body and mind, you've got the Tantra. And if you want practical details, you've got the Pali Canon. So we've got all three, hopefully, happening on this retreat. The Mahayana vision, the Tantric rites, and the Pali teachings for practical details. So I'll just end there by just saying that when he starts off the Sigalaka Sutta, the Buddha talks about finding a loyal friend. And the loyal friend is the Suhada. Suhada friendship means good-hearted or sound at heart. So it's basically saying that the basis of friendship is emotional warmth. It's not about being clever or witty or intelligent or anything like that. In a way, the essence of friendship is metta, and that's what we'll be developing on this retreat. If you can cultivate metta, the rest will follow. And, you know, finding friends, friendship can bring up all sorts of things. It can be a rather self-conscious process. And sometimes people get into this state of, oh, I don't have any friends or anything like that. Actually, you do. But don't worry if you feel clumsy in friendship. You know, it can be a difficult process. The main thing is to use the context that we've got to get to know each other. And friendship will emerge out of that. So we've got contexts here that are very helpful for friendship. We've got working together and meditating together. We've got eating together and hanging out together. We've got all those different concepts of friendship, studying together, being in groups together. So just to use those contexts in a way, that's the best thing to do, is to use those contexts, and friendship will emerge out of that.